Mr. Cochrane, Reel 17. Now, we just got you to Durban, South Africa. I think you'd arrived on the 3rd of September, according to your book. What happened in Durban?
Well, we landed at Durban and went straight on to a town called Pietermaritzburg, also in Natal. Not the main city, that was Durban. That it was the capital of Natal, the province, to a hospital there, which was in fact a convalescent hospital. And we had a lot of hospitality from local people, and we were given a fairly free rein if we wanted to, if we were asked to go and stay with people, as I was, by a schoolmaster who ran a boarding school up country near the hills, come and stay for a week. The hospital let you go with no bother. And I enjoyed that because I was getting more mobile. I could even sit on a pony when we were when I was up at this school. And in fact, I had been told that I was going to be given 6 months convalescent leave in South Africa, of which I had mixed feelings about. The people we'd met were very agreeable. The countryside was stunning. After being in an Indian division, I was shocked profoundly by signs in the park saying "whites only" on a bench here or a bench there. And one suddenly realised what the apartheid, which I think wasn't then at its full bloom as it became after the war, but it was still pretty off-putting, since the Indian Army, of course, was totally free from anything like that. But I hadn't been there very long when I was told that the thing was changed and that I and some others were going to be repatriated and shipped back to the UK. And I think it was in September sometime that we actually sailed from Cape Town. It was a rather slow journey because the ship had engine trouble. It was a Dutch liner which had converted into it wasn't covered in red crosses, but it was in fact really 90% a hospital ship, mostly people who could walk about like me. So we spent several weeks in, or fortnight at least, I think a bit more, in dry dock in Nova Scotia before eventually disembarking at Liverpool. And then I went to a place called Ormskirk in Lancashire, and there we all, over a period of 2 or 3 days, were interviewed and checked by a medical board, and I was put in medical category C, and given 4 weeks leave, which I spent with my family. My father was then, he was a civil engineer and was, amongst other things, in charge of patching up the Liverpool docks and keeping them going in spite of the very heavy bombing that was taking place. And then after my 4 weeks leave, I was posted, ironically enough, to what was called the 2nd Battalion, the Queen's Own Cameron Highlanders, in the Shetland Islands. Now, this was, first of all, it had been a territorial battalion, and it had been sent out to the West Indies. Quite why, I don't know. It had been made up to strength with a good many conscripts, and it had a few old soldiers mostly the NCOs, who either had been at one time with our 1st Battalion, which had been in France in 1940, and had seen, unlike some battalions, pretty stiff fighting before being the remains of and evacuated from Dunkirk. I'd rather point this reason, I think. It was rechristened the 2nd Battalion because the 2nd Battalion I had served with, by this time, had been involved in the fall of Tobruk, and those who still survived or had managed to make their getaway were all prisoners of war in Italy. So instead of being the old 4th Battalion, it became the 2nd Battalion, which is rather pointless in one way. And I find myself with one or two people who had been with me in the 2nd Battalion. It was a curious mix-up, because it was in some ways the people who, the old territorials, had a kind of guilty conscience of having had rather a cushy war so far in the West Indies, which meant really, I think, that they wanted to show themselves as keen as mustard. And I think they were not helped by the fact that we had a very bad commanding officer. He was an old soldier. He was intelligent. He was a very good linguist. He'd been parachuted into Yugoslavia to help the partisans, as they became known as. He'd been withdrawn from there when the government decided that the Hajlovic and the Croats were in fact not interested in fighting the Germans. They were more interested in fighting with the Germans against the forces under Tito. He then got command of the battalion. He was a great warrior, but not a great warrior, I'm afraid. He was conscientious to the nth degree, but he was a dismal sort of man, and always gave the impression that he didn't much enjoy. He got no fun out of being the colonel of the battalion, so nobody else got much fun out of being in the battalion. So I was very glad, eventually, to be put in command of C Company, Charlie Company once again, my old company, though of course all new people, and to be sent off on detachment away from the rest of the battalion, where one could buckle down to the rather interesting job of trying to get this lot up to the standard of the old Charlie Company, which of course consisted entirely, apart from me, of regular soldiers.
Now, where was this detachment at?
A place called Voe, V-O-E, where there was nothing but our little missing huts and a few cottages dotted around.
So now, this was in December 1942. Now, we have actually jumped a year, but I don't particularly want to go back except just to sketch in what you did, because that's when you went to America, wasn't it?
Ah, yes.
Because you came out of the, you were graded C, and you were sent to Fort Grange, was it?
Fort George.
Fort George.
Sorry, I have jumped.
But it's not so much, I just want you to sketch in what you did.
Well, going back to after my medical board and my 4 week leave, I was actually, first of all, sent to Fort George, which is on the Murray Firth. Our depot, Cameron Barracks, had been handed over to the ATS, and so we were sharing as our depot the Seaforth depot, which was Fort George. And it was a very busy training recruits, and I was let off that because I was still in Category C, and the commanding officer very kindly said, "What do you think will get you fit?" And I said, "Well, as soon as the fishing season starts, fishing, sir." So he said, "Right, you go and fish." And from there, in the summer of 42, I was sent to an officer cadet training unit in Wales, which was I don't know, I suppose it was as good as they are, but not nearly as good as it could have been, I didn't think. And I eventually volunteered to get out of it. I volunteered for the, they were asking for volunteers for the parachute regiment. I think it was called at that time regiment, rather than a sort of corps or anything. And I volunteered for that. But before I could be, go for a medical, whether I would have passed muster, because my legs were not brilliant, I don't know. But anyhow, I was sent for to the War Office, and I thought this was perhaps because I'd been complaining about the standards of teaching and so on at this cadet training unit. But no, it was to check that my particulars and my records were correct, that I had been an undergraduate at Oxford when the war began. And so I said yes, so he said, "Right, you will do." And a chap from the RAF and a chap from the Navy and I, the three of us, were sent over to the United States. We were there for about 3 months, ostensibly for a thing called the International Student Assembly. Then, when that was over, we were sent round, split up, and sent by a little international group, two of them. One round the eastern colleges of the US, one round the west coast ones. Well, I say east and west. I think our lot went as far as Michigan. As far as the east was concerned. The idea, one of the girls who was helping to organize this was somebody who later became my wife. We got married in 1943, when she was sent over to the American Embassy in London. She told me long after that one of the reasons for sending us with other people, like a Dutch naval lieutenant, two young Russian soldiers, a redoubtable Russian girl who was a sniper of great repute. One of the reasons for sending these ex-students around the American colleges was unobtrusively to point out the fact that being a student was not going to get American young people out of the draft. They were still going to be in the forces of one way or another. Well, whether that was so or not, I don't know. Anyhow, it was good fun. It was a wonderful interlude from the war, to which we all went back. And then, after I got back from this trip, that I found that the 4th Battalion had been turned into the 2nd Battalion, and I was posted to join them.
And this is when you went to Vaux. That's fine. Just to fill in that year, otherwise people would have wondered. And there is more about that in your book, Charlie Company, for people who wish to look into that in a little more detail. Now, I'd like to concentrate now on how you went about this training to get your new Charlie Company, C Company, back up to the level of the regulars. How did you go about it?
Well, I was lucky in having... when I'd first been in that battalion, I'd been in charge of the carrier platoon, and there was a very good platoon sergeant, was a regular soldier, came from Newcastle, but he was a camera into his fingertips. And when I was sent to C Company, there was a vacancy for Company Sergeant Major, and I asked for Owens, his name was, I asked for Sergeant Owens to be promoted and come as the Company Sergeant Major. And I had two very good platoon sergeants in the company, one not quite so good as he later became. So that's the main thing, I think, to start with. Good NCOs. Good not merely at soldiering, certainly not merely good at drill, but NCOs who are actually good with people. Good disciplinarians, but good with people. If you've got that, getting the officers right isn't so difficult, because they will, like Sergeant Horbury, when I was a brand new second lieutenant, they guide their platoon officer in the right way if he appears doubtful of what the right way is. And the other thing is, being away on our own, we could do as we wanted. So, I mean, first thing was physical fitness. And we did this with route marching in the daytime and then at night, then cross-country approach movements again at night. By encouraging,
did you do it with them? I mean, did your legs stand up to it?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I was all right for that. The thing I did find difficult was booted runs. That's the army phrase. In other words, you went for those days there no other footwear, so you went for a run on the road. 4 or 5 miles with your boots on, wearing your PT kit, that looked rather curious. But again, it was a good means of getting fit. And then when you were doing things in the dark, over very wild, not mountainous, but very boggy terrain in the Shetlands, with no very obvious landmarks to steer by, so you had to work by the stars and hunch, and doing things in small detachments in these conditions. Well, did two things. One, get people used to not being bewildered in the dark, and secondly, not being unaware of who their immediate neighbours were, i.e. the other soldiers in their section and in their platoon. And this, of course, also helped in the standard way by games. Football, of course, was we played a lot of football. We couldn't play with other companies, they were too far away. So we had platoon competitions, and everybody played in those, NCOs, officers, as well as the soldiers. Very important to find, exactly, I think, probably is true the school children, try and find something that people are good at. And you hope that they'll be good at military things, but sometimes somebody who's not much good at yes, he can march and keep up, but he's never going to make us, or he's never going to be fit for promotion to the NCO. But he may be a dab hand on the mouth organ, and so you encourage him. He's the one that you make sure he always takes his boothie with him, and at rest points or breaks in the march or something, you know, call out, give us a tune, and something that people could sing to. Other people were good at different things. I mean, football is an obvious example. And the it's always a very good thing to find the best centre forward or the ideal goalie. In fact, is a private soldier who may not written off, but he's platoon commander, or section commander, don't think all that much of him. Get them something they're good at, and if they're appreciative of what they're good at, they're much, much quicker to learn what they're not good at but need to learn. Never treat somebody as though he haven't got some merit which he may not really be fully aware of. And if we do all this, because we're on our own, we weren't totally isolated. I think quite often there was a lorry that would go into Lerwick, which was the main town, for the bar, and there would be a cinema and so on. But for all that mattered, we were really on our own.
Would you go in with the men to the bar? I mean, were you that much part of the group, or...?
No, I didn't. I'll tell you why. I've always done this. Later on, when I in Civvy Street, when I was working, going into the bar at the end of the day or the end of the week was very good for me. I didn't do it in the army. I don't know whether it would be frowned on or not, but I thought that this would be difficult for the soldiers, embarrassing for them, cramping their style a bit. When they're off having a drink in the bar, it's the time they can really let their hair down, what they thought about that shit who was a commanding officer or something. Let them have a chance of doing so. Don't cramp them.
How did you get on with them generally, would you say?
I find no trouble with them. I never... disciplinary problems were, I think, new. Mainly because, there's very little naughty you could get up to when you were sitting in the middle of a peat bog. But also, there were no... there was no, not even petty crime. You know, when I mean petty crime, I mean if somebody, because he's lost his socks, pinch his neighbour's pair of socks and that sort of thing. The other thing I thought was important was drill. But a good drill, a unit that drills well and knows it drills well, it's a great form of creating cohesion. But equally, I'm quite convinced that it was pointless and counterproductive to go on and on and on drilling. So what I used to do was really insist on a high standard of drill over this. Company Sergeant Major Owens was a great help. But then if the standard was good, arm skill and foot drill. All this was on our little tiny asphalt parade ground. I cut the whole thing short, and after 10 minutes, knock off, everybody could go and have free time. And this rather scandalised Owens, but particularly coupled if the drill was sloppy or bad, if we had the full 60 minutes of it, it underlined the fact that a good drill was worth it. And drill is not, as some people think, a complete waste of time. Because I say it's a very cohesive thing if we're done well, and if soldiers know they're performing drill well, there is a satisfaction in it. But not if it goes on and on and on and on. And I think we all got to know each other.
What about the other officers? Because you had a few officers.
Well, yes, instead of being one of two officers, or for a long time the only officer, I had a second in command and two other ones. Sometimes three other ones. They came and went a bit, but Actually, when we got as far as the action in Italy, I still had the second in command and two of the original three platoon commanders. And the third one came along.
How did you get on with them?
Very well. They were older than I was, I think. Except yeah, one of them was younger, but the others were older than I was. They'd all had, you know, jobs in Sydney Street of one sort and another. We had a half a missing hut. Was the officer's mess. Except we spent quite a bit of time in our own sort of tiny area of Missing Hut, which was our living quarters. And there we talked and talked a great deal. And of course, if you do that, you get to know people. Ins and outs. And they had all sorts of their jobs that were very different. So they could tell stories about this stuff. And then, of course, they all talked about Britain was going to be after the war. I never met anybody in the war who wasn't convinced we were going to win, even at times when it didn't look on the paper very likely. But everybody had their idea of what it was going to be like after the war.
And what was your idea? Because you'd been on this American conference.
I'm not sure if we talked much or thought much about international film. By this time, 1942, I think America was at it, the original rather sort of had a job getting Congress to bid him to send ships and things to this barrier now sort of, if you like, eased, and seeing supplies were coming in. Particularly, of course, America now had been in the war for nearly a year after Pearl Harbor. But we did talk a great deal about the things that we thought had been rotten before the war and have to be changed. And so we each had our private utopias. I suppose quite a lot of them coincided. The ones who we actually had been working and had jobs could obviously bring a pinch of salt or common sense to any rather rarefied flights of fancy I might have had, with sheer ignorance of what the working world was like. So we did, as I say, got to know each other well, and we got to know the soldiers well, and they knew us. And it was a huge advantage of being on our own, being a company on detachment. So that by the time we got our movement orders, had to go down to off Shetland, down to the I think it was in October.
43.
Yes, that's right.
So you were out at Vaux for most of the period?
Most of the time, yes. And for some reason, to my memory, they didn't shift companies about. We were never hauled back to be a company in at Lerwick, at battalion headquarters. We were left to get on with it. During this period, this was when my wife had been sent, well, she was then my fiancée, sent over to London. And so we had, we got married, and we had, I think it was 5 days, or perhaps even weeks, honeymoon. And then back to the Shetlands, where I found that the Tower Company, since of course all this went through the army telephone service, and telegrams and so on, I found that the whole company had been taking bets on would the marriage take place or wouldn't it. So I got a great welcome from those who'd been betting on the fact that it would come off.